Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to April's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I am delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RZVS recognised specialist in diagnostic imaging, Pete Mantis. Thank you, Pete. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma. We had a little bit of an eventful login. If everybody can hear me, can you please raise your hands? And if you can hear me clearly. If not, please leave a message so that Emerald can see what is the issue. My name is Pete Mantis. I'm the radiologist at the Royal Vet College. And today we are going to go through the secret of successful film reading in small animal practice. Any questions you have at any point, feel free to raise your hand and start typing your question, and I will be happy to answer it. You can do it during the lecture or at the end, whichever suits you best. So today I'm going to cover a lot of the basics, because effectively that's where we kind of mess when we look at radiographs, though it seems to most of us that it's not the basics, it's the more detailed stuff. So let's start, and whenever you have a question, please feel free to stop me. Now, when we view a radiograph, you heard that many times, we need a quiet area that we can adequately darken, and we need some peace and quiet to look at it. And I know the arguments, I've been there. You will probably say, how can I do that? I have a list of clients to see, that's one case. One way to go around that, that I used many times when I was doing practice, was to say to the owner that we'll have a quick look, it looks normal, and then I'll have another look later on when it's more quiet. If I spot something, I will let you know. And that, at least in the beginning, gives you the opportunity to go later and see the radiograph in some peace and quiet, probably in a more dark room than the one you are actually examining, without having, you know, somebody over your head. Now, if you are still using boxes, we need at least two view boxes. You heard it again, we'll say it again. You need two orthogonal views. My advice is try not to cut corners. We're dealing with three-dimensional animals, so we need at least two views to realize where everything is in three dimensions. If you use view boxes, it's good to have a bright light illuminator for those kind of darker parts of the radiographs. Some people nowadays, actually most of people, and it becomes more and more common, we use a computer to see the radiographs because we have a CR or a DR system. That's fantastic. A perfect scenario would be to have a double screen. You know, two high definition screens next to each other. If that's not possible, you may consider a split screen or a way to display the two radiographs on the one screen. So you can see, for example, a thorax, a lateral and a dorsoventral at the same time, if at all possible. Try to get a high definition screen, if at all possible. The resolution is important. Now, we set the basics. We need to create the three-dimensional concept. Okay, so we need to have a three-dimensional picture of what we see. And as we said before, in order for us to do that, we require to have two minimum radiographic views, a lateral and a dorsoventral or ventrodorsal, and if you like, a lateral and a craniocaudal. Okay, anything at right angles so we can actually see those radiographs. Now, most of us, including me, sometimes we stuck on anatomy. So we look at something and we are not sure. Is that normal? Should it be there? You know, is it something different? Then we need to have anatomy and radiology textbooks for reference. Arlene Coulson has a very good one. That's her last name, in radiographic anatomy. Donald Thrall has also another good one for radiographic anatomy that you can actually use as a reference. On the other hand, you can create your own anatomy in a way of whenever you find a normal radiograph, while normally the tendency is to put it on the side and never deal with it again, now you can keep it in a box or in a file and make a note. For example, this is a normal boxer thorax of a skeletally mature boxer. And then whenever you have another boxer thorax and you wonder, is that normal or abnormal, you can always go back, for example, and see if that is right. Slowly over time, that way you can create your own normal radiographic anatomy reference. Otherwise, you can use the books and don't be, feel sorry or have any drawbacks about it. Radiologists, they use that all the time. I use them if needed. So have them handy and, you know, basically use them. Now, when we examine the radiograph, I start with checking the label. And this is not when it's our radiograph. Hopefully we know. But if the radiograph has been taken by somebody else, how many times I have received radiographs that are from different dates and either it was not noticed, you know, and that will affect how you think about the abnormality, or even worse, from different animal. Imagine if it was also the same size. If you don't see the label and see that this is a different animal and you don't spot it, then you can appreciate the problems. If it is our radiographs, hopefully we know what we've done. Always identify the right and the left side on a radiograph. And you will say, why can't we do it on the radiograph? You can. And you can find you can read about it and see how you can say if it is the right side or the left side. But there is a condition called situs inversus, where all the organs are the other way around. And the only way to actually identify that is to have the radiograph properly marked. Otherwise, what you're going to do, look at the radiograph and say, oops, I put it the wrong way around and just flip it over. And you will miss that. So it's a good idea to always have a right and a left marker, one of the two, to indicate which side is which. And I will never stop emphasizing that. Good quality radiographs. Most people assume nowadays that effectively, because we have a CR or a DR, suddenly the computer will fix everything. The reality of the matter is you cannot compensate for proper positioning. If the animal is jumping off the table, no matter how good you are going to miss stuff. So always try to position the animal properly and try to take the best radiograph you can. In a computer, you can always compensate a little bit about the brightness, maybe a little bit about the exposure, but you can't really compensate about positioning. And it is easy to end up with the wrong diagnosis or actually making false assumption because it looks funny. So always try to take the best, most appropriate radiograph you can. And I wouldn't emphasize that enough. Don't cut corners. That is very, very important there. Now, the important bit, how to look at radiographs. You know, and there is only one rule. I can tell you that, you know, and that's the only rule you have to follow from whatever I tell you from now on. You know, examine the whole radiograph. That's the only rule. Check everything that is on the film or on the screen. And you will say, yeah, genius, how am I going to do that? And that's what I'm going to advise you from now on. But the only rule is check the whole radiograph. Why? Because we cannot always predict a lesion based on the clinical signs. Some lesions could be suggested by the history, but others are unexpected. And many diseases like trauma may have unpredictable patterns. So you may as well finish this lecture here and say examine the whole radiograph. But that is, I think, only the beginning. It took me a while to try and figure out what's the best way to do it. And that's what I'm going to talk from now on, especially when we start. When we have experience, then we kind of have our own way. But when we start, it's always a good idea to find a proper way to do it. But before I actually introduce what I usually suggest to my students and to everybody I meet about radiographs is have a systematic method. Examine all parts of the film, and the key word here is actively. Don't just gaze on the radiograph. And you will say, how do I do that? Don't worry, it's coming. I would recommend you to do it. But have you seen people, especially when we were in school, in the vet school, and they were looking on a radiograph for half an hour, and then somebody passes, suddenly goes, that's a nice mass. And then they spent another half hour trying to actually figure out why they didn't see the obvious mass. It's because they were not actively looking at the radiograph. They were gazing, expecting at the point the lesion to kind of jump off the radiograph and say, here I am. And so, of course, they missed it and they wonder why. I will give you some tips on that, so don't worry for the time being. Second very important point, each abnormality, try to be specific in which anatomic structure it can be. Don't just drop something it is in the cranial thorax or in the caudal abdomen. That's very general. Try to be specific. And some of you will say, wait a minute, yeah, I can say it's probably could be liver or could be something in the spleen there, but I'm not clear. Don't worry. Specify it down to these two organs you can, or three, but don't just leave it open out there. Give specific information to your brain. When you finish, try to make an appropriately specific diagnosis. And this is not what most people think. Most people think they will do an x-ray and get an answer. That's a diagnosis. And that is not actually true. Sometimes, or actually most of the time, you will end up with two or three most possible diagnoses. And you will need to do something more. Get comfortable with that. It's not always the case that you're going to finish a reading of a radiograph actually having a diagnosis. So, we'll talk about how to actively examine the parts, all parts of the film. I will ask you to be very specific when you describe, especially on the location. Don't leave it general. And when you arrive at a diagnosis, again, you try to be as specific as possible, but don't try to overdo it. Now, before I give you the actual way that I recommend to my students, I will go again back to the basics because they are very, very important. When we look at the radiographs, we find an abnormality, try to describe it in detail. Use all the radiographic signs. Use number, size, shape, location, margination, and radioopacity. Why? Because if I come and tell you there is an opacity in the cranial thorax, take a few seconds and think how many differences you can come up with. Chances are you are going to say, are you crazy? I can think one differential per page in the biggest medicine book I can find. I'm totally in agreement with that. Now let's rephrase the same one and say I have 2 centimeters in diameter, rounded, soft tissue opacity, well marginated in the right cranial lung lobe. How many differences you can think now? Suddenly, without even me saying anything, just because you were specific, you had 2 centimeter well marginated soft tissue opacity in the right cranial lung lobe, suddenly your brain narrowed down everything. And that could have been the increased opacity in the cranial thorax. But increased opacity in the cranial thorax is like telling you, I saw a car with color on the M25 in London. I'm not telling you much. What color? What car? You need specifics. It's the same when we look at a lesion. So from now on, whenever you find a lesion, describe it using the radiographic signs. Number, size, shape, location, margination, radioopacity. One more step here. When you come to radioopacity, avoid the tendency to say opaque. Most people, they just go there and say opaque. And that's it. Opaque means nothing to your brain. You have to be specific. So whenever you go to opacity, avoid at all costs saying opaque. Say exactly what opacity. And from more lucent to more opaque, we have gas lucency, fat, soft tissue, fluid is also soft tissue opacity. So from now on, I don't want to hear anyone saying that's a fluid opacity, it's not soft tissue. They are the same opacity. Then we have bone and then we have mineral. And we can see each of those opacities in every radiograph. For example, in the thorax, sometimes we have the falciform fat or subcutaneous fat or fat in the mediastinum. We can see the fat. We have the lung with the gas. We have the soft tissues like the cardiac silhouette or the liver. We have bone like the ribs. And then you will say, genius, where is the mineral? And if it is normal, where is the mineral? The mineral is either the marker or the unexposed part. So we can see all the opacities from gas to mineral in every view. So when we find something, we go number, size, shape, location, margination, radiopacity. We are specific when we come to radiopacity, and we say that's fat opacity, that's soft tissue opacity. Okay. If somebody is unclear, raise your hand and start typing questions. And now it's that moment which I will tell you what I usually recommend to my students. And as I said, you don't have to actually do it. All you have to do is look at the whole radiograph in whichever way suits you. What I recommend is an anatomic method of examining films. What I like to call organ by organ. So when you have a thorax, when you have an abdomen, or you have a leg, go organ by organ, bone by bone, if you like, for musculoskeletal. Why? Because when you say cranial thorax, that's a lot of organs in there. And I know all about multitasking, and I'm pretty sure that a lot of people are geniuses and they can actually do that and see many organs in one go. I'm not one of those. While if I tell you trachea, you will look at the trachea. You have a reference for the trachea. So if you tell me this trachea looks small, you can actually go onto your reference book and find out how big it should be. If you tell me the cardiac silhouette is big, you can always find the reference. But you can't really find the reference for the cranial abdomen, for example, or the cranial thorax. It's too many organs. So what I recommend is go organ by organ, whichever way it suits you. When I was a student, I had to do it from the center to the periphery. Tough bit, because basically my brain works the other way around. I actually like to go from the periphery to the center. And you will say, how did that work? You should see my grades in radiology. I was barely scraping through. It's unimportant. Go however you like. Head to toe, top to bottom, in circles, zigzag. I don't really care. Whatever suits you. And find a way to go organ by organ. Okay. Now, when you find something that is unusual, abnormal, you are not sure if it is normal or abnormal, you stop and you describe it. And you describe it using number, size, shape, location, margination, and radiopacity. And when we go to radiopacity, we said we are specific. Gas, fat, soft tissue, bone, and mineral. So whenever we find something that looks funky, normal, peculiar, I don't have a clue if it should look like that or not, we stop and we describe it in detail. Number, size, shape, location, margination, radiopacity. And when we come to opacity, as we said, we don't just say opaque. We say specifically which opacity we have in mind. Then we think structural changes, and that boils down usually to what has happened to cells or fluid. For example, why this lung lobe that normally is loosened because it contains air has become soft tissue opacity. And of course, the immediate structural change is air has left the building. So what has replaced the air? Usually we have about two choices, fluid or cells. And there you go, that's the structural change. Then we go to what type of fluid or cells we know in that particular example. For example, fluid, you may know edema, hemorrhage, pus. There you go. If you have cells, inflammatory, could be neoplastic, and that will give you your first differential list. And of course, if it is, for example, edema, could be pulmonary edema. If it is inflammatory cells, would be pneumonia. If it is hemorrhage, would be pulmonary hemorrhage. If it is neoplastic cells, would be tumor. If it is pus, it will be abscess. Now it's the time to combine what we know and become kind of a little bit of a gambler. Let's say, for example, we had one lung lobe that was opaque. And we said, you know, in the differential, it could be edema, it could be hemorrhage, it could be neoplasia, could be pneumonia, or it could be an abscess. And then you go, okay, can it be edema? One lung lobe, likely no. Can it be hemorrhage? Yeah, if we have a trauma, but we don't, so it's further back. Can it be tumor in one lung lobe? You bet. Can it be pneumonia in one lung lobe? Absolutely. We even have a term called lobar pneumonia. Can it be an abscess? It could be. Abscesses, they tend to be more rounded. So you may go and say, okay, it looks like more likely pneumonia or neoplasia, less likely hemorrhage. Now, let's say that was a six-month-old German Shepherd. So which one would you pick between pneumonia and neoplasia? Start typing. I'm waiting for you to type down your answers so I can see them in the chat box. So, you decided it could be pneumonia or it could be neoplasia. And then you go and they tell you it's a six-month-old dog that is coughing and has a little bit of a fever. What is the most likely diagnosis you're going to think? Pneumonia or neoplasia? I don't know if you're typing. I hope you do. Excellent. Sorry, I was looking at the wrong box and thank God Emmer jumped in and said, look below. Absolutely, I will think pneumonia. Why? Six-month-old German Shepherds, they don't get neoplasia. They do, but what are the odds? Almost non-existent. So I will think, of course, most likely pneumonia. Why? It's a six-month-old dog, honestly. Now, let's change that. What if I said it was a 10-year-old dog? Suddenly, neoplasia would have become a possibility, possibly along with pneumonia, but you wouldn't be so confident to say pneumonia. And that's what I mean when I say we become a little bit of a gambler. Common things, as my teacher told me, are common. So start with the common things. And for a six-month-old dog, it's more common to have pneumonia than tumor. A 10-year-old German Shepherd most likely has high possibilities to also be a tumor, so you wouldn't be so confident. So that would be your diagnosis down there. Let's get rid some stuff from the board so we can actually see. So now you have one more step after your diagnosis. You said it could be pneumonia, edema. What's the next step? What is the test that's going to actually give me the answer or actually exclude the majority of my differential diagnosis? So, what do I recommend to my students to do? Start anatomically. Go organ by organ. Go back and see which organs we can see in the cavity or in that leg, which bones. And divide which order you want to go. I don't care how you're going to do it. Look at them. As soon as you find something that looks odd, funky, abnormal, I'm not sure, I cannot possibly consider that normal 100%. You stop and you describe. Number, size, shape, location, margination, radiopacity. Then you think structure. What has changed? Why is this lung more opaque? Why is this liver more rounded? Why is this kidney looking bigger or irregular? And you think, what has happened? Is it more cells? Is it more fluid? Is it a combination? Is it something else? And that is the type of pathology. That will give you your first differential diagnosis. Then you combine that with whatever you know, and you arrive to a smaller final diagnosis. Could be single as mega esophagus and aspiration pneumonia, but that's rare. Usually you will end up with more than one disease. And then, what am I going to do next? If I ask most of the students, they will probably not think and go, ooh, a blood test. Sometimes it's helpful, sometimes it's not. What I'm going to do next depends on what I'm looking to confirm or exclude. So I need to do the test that is going to offer me the diagnosis, or it will exclude the majority of the diseases. Now, let's see if everybody understands. So go to the raise your hand area and click agree if everybody's clear, or start typing if you are unclear about what we said so far. Okay, so hit the raise your hand, and in there you will see in the list agree or disagree. Disagree if you're still unclear, and then please type your question. Beautiful. Excellent. So you were paying attention. That's good. So now, and before we have some examples, I will give you some tips. I think it's a good idea after we discuss how we go about to actually give you some tips about thorax, some tips about abdomen, and a little bit about musculoskeletal, and finish with some examples more or less within our allocated time. So let's start with the thorax. Okay. When I look at the thorax, I like to start from the periphery. So effectively, I'm going to look at... I need to stop the pen. Let's get the draw out. Okay. So I will look at the subcutaneous tissue, the spine, sternum on both views, ribs, whatever can be counted, I will count. For example, thoracic vertebrae, sternebrae, ribs. And you will say, why? What will happen if I have one less or one more? And the answer is, nothing will happen, basically. But by counting them, I force my eye to look at each and every one of them. So I will do that. Then, if there is a shoulder, for example, a front limb and a scapula, I will see those, you know, on both views again, because I'm trying to create a three-dimensional structure. Then, I will look at the cranial abdomen and see, can I see the liver, the stomach, for example? I will check the diaphragm. And then, after I finish with the surrounding structures, that's me, because I know if I don't look at them at the beginning, I will never look at them. You know, when you miss a few stuff while training, you learn how to compensate. Then I go inside and start looking at the inside organs, like, for example, the trachea on both views, the cranial mediastinum, the aorta, and we can see here, the coda vena cava, where we can see here, the cardiac silhouette. And then I concentrate on the lungs, cranial, middle, caudal lung fields, on both views, looking at the vessels, the artery, bronchus, and vein, that we can see the triad in the lungs. And when I will finish, I will say, did I forget to look at something? You know, for example, here we can see a little bit of opacity here because there is a little bit of fluid in the caudal esophagus. Still, could be an incidental. It's a normal animal. But always I finish looking and saying, did I forget to check something? And by saying that, I'm just giving you an example. I don't try for you to use my technique. You may work better center to periphery, cranial to caudal. By all means, use whatever works for you. And a common question I get is, what if I decide on a technique and then effectively somebody comes and says, you know, mine is better, or I think somebody else's technique is better, or I find, you know, another way of going around the organs much easier for me. Change it. It's not written in stone. For example, if you went from cranial to caudal and now you found out 10 years later you prefer from the periphery to the center, by all means, change that. You know, it's not written in stone. Just make sure you check the whole radiograph. Now, mediastinum, we don't see much. We see the cranial mediastinum, which is this soft tissue opacity below the trachea and between the lung lobes on the DV. We see a little bit the cranial ventral mediastinal reflection, which is actually this line here. And we can see the caudoventral mediastinal reflection, which is actually this line here. That looks like connects the apex of the heart to the diaphragm. So from mediastinum, we don't see much. And from mediastinal organs, effectively, we only see Some like the trachea, aorta, cardiac silhouette, coda vena cava. Again, trachea, cardiac silhouette, you know, the aorta and the coda vena cava back there. So we don't see the specific smaller vessels or nerves or lymph nodes normally in the mediastinum. And that's an important point to make. Now, when we see in the ribs, you can see the difference at the top. Let me get the arrow here. When we have a ventrodorsal to a dorsoventral projection, you see how the ribs look differently. Okay, a little bit more kind of straight towards the dorsoventral, if you like. Now, a confusion area is usually the mineralization of the costal cartilages. And that's why I put it here. Why? Because effectively, most people, they have in their mind that the costal cartilage starts from the one end and continues getting mineralized from one end to the other, while in reality we have islands of mineralization. So they are taken by surprise when they find a rib with gaps in the cartilage and they think there is a fracture. If these lines align, that's fine. You shouldn't worry, it's usually the way the cartilages get mineralized. If there is a displacement, then absolutely you have to think fracture. And fracture in the cartilage or in the ribs can be very, very tricky to identify. Now, in the last one, there are some fractured ribs at the bottom. Oops, let me get a drawing out now. There we go. So if you look at the back, you will see some fractured ribs. And they're very, very easy to miss. You know, the ribs, they're kind of overlying the thorax. Sometimes we don't even pay attention to them. That's why it's a good idea to actually, when you look at the ribs, count them. Not because if you find 14 ribs or 15 ribs, it's something exciting, except the pleasure that you actually spotted it, but because that way you force your eye to look individually at each and every rib. And for the rib, I have a nice way for that it helps me to them. When I have a normal radiograph like this one, the ribs kind of being lost because our eyes used to see it like that. So what I like to do is to put radiograph in a funky way. In this case, I can flip it over and suddenly the ribs kind of stand out because my eye is not used to see the radiograph like that. So I can count them and see them more clearly. You know, if I have a ventrodorsal or dorsoventral, I actually may flip it around. I put it in an odd orientation that my eye is not used to see it, so that I can actually have a better look at ribs. Again, give me an agree if we are all clear, or start typing if you have a question, and put disagree just to indicate that there is an issue and something is unclear to you. I can see so far agreements, so give me a shout if someone disagrees. Excellent. Let's move to the abdomen. And one thing that most people don't pay attention when we look at the abdomen is that in the abdomen there are organs we can see. There are organs we not normally see and we organs that may see or may not see. So, let's start. Organs that we can see normally, usually if you like. Stomach, liver, urinary bladder, small intestine and colon. These organs, we are going to see them on the radios, or at least we should expect to see them. Organs that we may see partially, spleen, kidneys, prostate gland. Sometimes we may not see the kidney, especially on a ventrodorsal view. And then some people, they don't know that this can be normal. They get a little bit surprised. What happened? Okay. So these are organs that we may see or we may not see, but sometimes, most commonly, we see them, but only part of them, not all of them. For the spleen, for example, we may see on the ventrodorsal the head and on the lateral the tail. For the kidneys, we may see some of them, all of them, or none of them. And organs we do not normally see, and that includes the pancreas, we only wish. the adrenal glands, the ovaries, and the mesenteric lymph nodes. So we don't see those, which means if we see them, something is wrong. And in the adrenal glands, I have put an asterisk, and you will say why. Because in cats, the adrenals can get mineralized. And that is an incidental finding. But then you will be able to see them. If it is a cat, worry not. They can get mineralized. Focally, a focus in there, or the whole adrenal. If it is a dog, we start worrying about a tumor, but not in cats. And that's why I put this caveat over there. So if you see the adrenals in cats mineralized, that's probably an incidental finding, but not in dogs. Another small detail. The amount of detail we see depends also on the amount of fat in the abdomen. For example, in adult dogs, we have more fat. So we can see, for example, the spleen, easier the walls of the intestines, and so on and so forth. In puppies, because of less fat, suddenly the whole abdomen merges and, oops, I need again to get rid of the drawing, I think. There we go. And all we see is some gas, oops, again, wrong button, sorry about that. All we see some gas in the intestine, the stomach, but we don't see much of margination of the organs because there is not much fat in there. Okay, this is called loss of serosal detail. And actually we can track that, we can deal with that right now. When we see loss of serosal detail, so we don't see organ margins, there are four things we should mainly think of. One is lack of fat, like a young animal or actually an animal that is emaciated or very, very thin. Two, ascites, so fluid in the belly. That will give this what they call hourglass appearance. It's more soft tissue opacity, but you don't see details. Three, peritonitis, so inflammation. It could be ascites and peritonitis. You cannot necessarily distinguish two and three. They may be both. Four is what they call peritoneal seeding. Probably you've heard the term. Basically, it means micro nodular metastasis. Okay, so if we don't see detail in the abdomen, we can see the gas in the GI tract, but not much margin, we have to think lack of fat, ascites, peritonitis, or tumor spread throughout the abdomen. Now that we said all that, liver, we can see the liver, and the liver is usually cranial. In this radiograph from a cat, we can see the liver here, usually within the rib cage. Sometimes it can extend behind the rib cage. Okay, as long as it is pointy, I don't particularly mind about that. I consider that normal. We can use the gastric axis. Let me just change that. So when we see the stomach, we can identify the axis by bringing a line from the fundus to... Oh, I need to change color to be more visible. I will make it black again. So, from the fundus to the pylorus, and that's the gastric axis. This gastric axis should be from parallel to the ribs up to vertical to the spine. And that's the normal orientation. If it sits more caudal than that, we consider a big liver. If it sits more cranial than that, we consider a small liver. So, liver, cranioventral abdomen, usually within the rib cage and sharp, and we can use the gastric axis to actually identify whether it's big or small. Spleen, usually on the lateral, we may see the tail of the spleen. In the old days, they thought that basically in cats, if we see that it's splenomegaly, it's not the case. Actually, we can also see it sometimes in cats. And if we see it on the vetrodorsal view, we see it on the left behind the stomach as a small triangle there. Now, on radiograph, we can suspect splenomegaly when the spleen is big, subjectively, and you can see the margins being more rounded. But unless it's a huge splenomegaly, we can only suspect it. The stomach, the appearance varies. And one image I like to have in my mind to figure out how the stomach would look is if I cut a slice at the level of the stomach. So at the top I have dorsal, ventral, right and left. You can say I'm a radiologist because I always put the right on our left, like we put the radiographs. Stomach is like a J. And I have the fundus, body and pylorus. Now, if you keep in mind that gas or air always goes up, fluid or solid always goes down, you can appreciate where the gas should be depending on how the animal lies. For example, in this radiograph, this cat is lying on the right side. That's a right lateral. So if this lies on the right, most of the gas will go up to the fundus and body, which is what we see here. If it was lying on the left, we will have more gas in the pylorus, which will be down here. So we would have seen it down at the bottom. So using this simple drawing, you can actually identify where the gas should be in the stomach, providing it's not filled with gas. Very, very handy, especially if you're looking for a GDV. So all I try to remember is this drawing in my head. And then if I know that the gas goes up, fluids and solids, they go down, that can work. Wait a minute, I think we jumped the slide quickly. That was too energetic. Small intestine. Small intestine, it's difficult to see individual segments, but we can see some of those. And what we use is the diameter of the small intestine, especially in the dog, we compare it, like here, with the height of the body of the fifth lumbar vertebra. So that's 7, that's 6, that's 5. So we go to and take only the height of the mid body, where I draw the line. So, and we compare it. Okay, and it should be normally less. Or we can use the thickness of a rib, the width of a rib, and the small intestine in dog should be less than twice the rib thickness or width. So this is a good rule of the thumb to use. In the cat, the small intestinal diameter should be less than 12 millimeters, okay, or less than twice the height of the central part of the L2, 432. There we go. So if that was a cat, I would see the height of the central part of the L2 and the small intestine should be less than twice that. These are good rules of the thumb to use when we start. It helps you to decide if the small intestine is dilated or not. With experience, you're not going to use them. But when we start, they offer this extra piece of confidence that sometimes we lack to make a decision. The colon, we can actually see, we have the cecum to start with, which is like a U shape, and usually we see L3, L4, sometimes can go as back as L5, and is usually C or U shape. Okay, now the colon, we can see, and usually a rule of the thumb is the diameter of the colon should be less than the length of the body of the L7 vertebra. So one rule of the thumb we normally use is the length of the body of the 7th lumbar vertebra. Kidneys, I won't tell you anything about the location, you know it better than I do, but the length, we use the ventrodorsal view, not any other view, ventrodorsal, and we have the kidney. Sorry about my drawing is not ideal, but we can correct on that. So, if I have a kidney, there it is, and I have the length of the L2 vertebra. In the dog, the kidney length on the ventrodorsal should be 2.5 to 3.5 times the second lumbar vertebra. In the cat, 1.8 to 2.4. For the ureters, we don't really see them, unless they are dilated or contain some stones in there. Intravenous urogram helps us identify the kidneys because sometimes we don't even see them and see also the ureters. So I will remove my drawings so you can see it on both sides and you can see it also on, oops, I need to learn to remove the draw. So you can see it also on the left and you can see the ureter going down. And of course, when we do an IVU, we take 0, 5, 10 minutes VDs and 15 minutes laterals to actually see the termination of the ureters in the bladder. very easy technique. You know, 800 milligrams of iodine per ml, push IV, and you actually take the x-rays at 0, 5, 10, and 15 minutes. And then further if required. Bladder, we can see it, and the cat is usually more inside, and the dog is a little bit further back. It's soft tissue opacity, and it's clearly visible. Urethra, it is behind the bladder, but we don't normally see them on survey radiographs. To actually see the urethra, we need contrast. And usually 10 to 15 ml will dull the job. Only when we inject, we take the radiograph during the injection of the last 2-3 ml. That's why we maintain the urethra being dilated. So we can actually see inside, and you can see here the jet. Because when we take, we actually still injecting. So we ask the person to shout so we can take where they inject the last 2-3 ml of contrast. In the female, of course, we have to do a vagina urethrogram, and then the vagina will fill up, and then we can see the urethra. Again, we take the radiograph while we inject the last 2-3 ml to identify it. Otherwise, on survey radiographs, we do not normally see the lumen of the urethra. The prostate, it is actually at the level of the pelvic inlet, and usually it's in the pelvic canal, but when the animal becomes 3 to 4 years old, then it comes more cranial, and then we can see it more. A good way to measuring the size is the one I described here. So basically, the prostate should be less than 70% the distance between the pubic rim and the sacral promontory. So just to go back, the prostate should be less than 70% the distance from the sacral promontory to the pubic rim. So you can see the distance of the pelvic inlet, and it has to be less than 70% this distance. And I will finish my description before we move to the musculoskeletal, basically with the uterus and the ovaries, and basically to tell you that unfortunately we don't really see them. Unless it's a very fat dog or cat, when we may see the uterine body, we don't normally see it unless it's pregnant. So there it goes. That was quick, or Pyometra, for example. Moving along, musculoskeletal to finish off. For the musculoskeletal, I like to use a technique we use for post-op radiographs, the ABCDS. A is for alignment, so I check the alignment of the bone. B is the bone, so I check the bone. If it is a long bone, I would like to have a cortex, a medulla, and another cortex. You know, this white, black, white. C is for cartilage, so I will check the joints. Why? Because effectively, if I have a fracture in a long bone, the joints, they get the impact. So we need to check them. If it is a post-op, D is for device. If it's not post-op, it's pre-op. Basically, I don't bother to look for a device. And the one thing we always forget to check is soft tissues. So the last one is S for soft tissues. So A, B, C, D, S. Whenever I have a musculoskeletal radiograph, I like to go through that. It makes me feel better. A, alignment. Are they aligned properly? B for bone. I go from proximal to distance personally. You want to do it the other way around? No problem. C is for cartilage, so I check the joints. D for device if it is post-op. S for soft tissues. And soft tissues is the one thing everybody forgets to check. And you know what? Sometimes it tells you which leg has the problem. How many times I had a pelvic radiograph because the dog is lame, and they go, we are not sure, they can't tell us, and it's not that clear, and suddenly you see one leg being with very little muscle and the other with a lot of muscle. So you're thinking, okay, clearly the little mass is atrophic. So it gives you an idea where the problem lies. What I find paramount when we look on radiographs is to define whether that's aggressive or not. And when we find the lesion, we have to look carefully if it is aggressive or not. And the hallmark of aggression is osteolysis. And basically, we have three types. One which is little or no aggressive, the geographic, which basically, if I bring it a little bit closer, you can see that I have a lesion with distinct margins. This grows slowly over time, and I can clearly see the margins of the lesion. It takes years to grow. Usually we see them with bone cysts, bone abscesses, and the rest. Then we have the other two, which are quite aggressive. Medium aggression is more thin. So basically, I have lesions that they look that the bones contains holes, like this osteosarcoma here, that basically like it was eaten by a moth. Have you seen a cloth eaten by a moth? That's how they look like. Permittive is the worst offender. Usually we have ill-defined lytic areas, and usually what I have in my mind when I look for permittive lysis, look at this dorsal spinous process of L5 there, I'm looking for small dots in the bone. Imagine a piece of cloth that you took a needle and you prick through it. You know, and that's the most aggressive of the lot. So when we have a bone lesion, what I think it's paramount is for us to decide, is this aggressive or not? And here is a list for you to help you with that. For example, aggressive lesions are usually metaphyseal. Why? That's where the blood supply usually enters. So there is a lot of food there for the tumor to grow. Could be diaphyseal. Non-aggressive are anywhere. Bone lysis, non-aggressive are usually, you remember the geographic, they're very well marginated. While the others, not only they are not very well marginated, they are actually, the margins are kind of unclear. So, moth-eaten and permittive. Then we look at the cortex. Is it intact or not? If it's not, we're thinking aggressive. We look at a margin. Non-aggressive lesions, you can pinpoint when they stop. Aggressive, you are a little bit reluctant to say. It's a little bit hazy to where exactly they finish. So, and that's why usually when we remove an aggressive bone lesion, we usually like a 5 centimeter at least clear cut. Periosteal new bone formation is usually smooth and continuous in non-aggressive, while it's irregular, interrupted if you like, in aggressive. Rate of change, non-aggressive lesions, they will take ages, and they will look similar, they don't grow fast. Aggressive, they really change fast within a couple of weeks. So this will give you an idea. You know, you see osteolysis, make sure is it aggressive or not. And have that for all bone lesions. Something for you to help depends on the location of the lesion. For example, if I find a lesion in the epiphysis of the bone, I'm thinking joint disease or metabolic endocrine disorders. If I find it in the physis, I'm thinking infection, angular limb deformity, and again metabolic or endocrine disorders. In the metaphysis could be neoplasia, infection, or metabolic or endocrine disorders. In diaphysis, we can have neoplasia, secondary, fractures, panosteitis, or infarction. On the distribution, if I have a single lesion, I have to think tumor, infection, direct infection, like a trauma, and cyst. If I have multiple bone lesions, then hematogenous infection or metastasis of tumors is actually of tumor is the most common thing that I have to think of. If it is all over the skeleton, then I have to think metabolic, nutritional, or endocrine disease. So something to kind of get us started. The one advice that I would like to actually tell you about the musculoskeletal is especially on young dog diseases. A lot of those diseases, like panosteitis, like retained cartilage, cores, they are what we call pattern recognition. So effectively, either you know that's how it looks, or most of the times you will not even identify that that's the disease. You will see the lesion, but you wouldn't know what it is. So my advice is get your notes or a book like Thrall's, for example, and then read about the immature skeleton diseases, because they are kind of pattern recognition that will help you. So we've said a lot so far, and I would like just to quickly finish with a couple of examples so I can keep more or less on time. And I will start with a thoracic radiograph of a cat like this one. So I hope you can see the radiographs. Was presented with a history. Of course, I will fictionalized the history. I can't even remember what was presented this one, but a common history is the cat presents for vaccination and the vet could not hear good lung sounds or good heart sounds, so he decided to take radiographs of the thorax. And here we have a right lateral thorax and a dorsoventral. Can you see the marker? Always the left. So, first of all, how we'll go here? I will look at the spine and count one, you know, let me put the arrow quickly. So, I will look at the spine and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 3, 6, 9, 12, 13, 14. There you go. Okay. I can see the dorsospinous processes. I can see the subcutaneous tissues. I can see the humerus. I can see the sternovertebrae and count them. Then I can see the ribs and count them. Then I will go into the cranial thorax. So, musculoskeletal, except the number, that I think it's nice, it's correct, I just overcounted before. The musculoskeletal looks okay, subcutaneous tissues look okay. I will go into the cranial abdomen, and I will say, okay, liver. Can I see the liver? Yes or no, please type now. Can we see the liver in the cranial abdomen here? I hope you're typing. No. Excellent. So, Jade says no. Like Helen. So, basically, I can't see the liver. Can I see the stomach? Yes or no? I'm waiting. It could be a little bit here, can't it? A little bit the stomach. What do I think about the intestines? Are they in normal position? More cranial, more caudal? I'm waiting. What about the intestines? More cranial. So effectively, in the cranial abdomen, looking there, you see immediately I can't see the liver. I can possibly see the stomach. And the small intestines, they look more cranial. Okay. What about the diaphragm? Can I see the diaphragm? All of it, yes or no, remember specifics. Can I see all of it? Can I see part of it? I can't see the diaphragm, okay. I can see the dorsal part and maybe a little bit laterally, but in the middle and ventrally, I can't see it. That's another note for me. Okay, then we move inside. What about the trachea? What do we think? Is it normal, dorsally positioned, ventrally positioned, big or small? Type quickly. Absolutely, the trachea is dorsally positioned. It's almost parallel to the spine here. Should have been a little bit down. Well done. Then, what about the cardiac silhouette itself? Number, size, shape, location, margination, radiopacity. Okay, I will give you the number. It's 1. What about the size, small or big? Start typing. Excellent, it's big, and somebody comments here, Helen says, cannot see the margins. Yeah, I can see the dorsal margins, but back with the diaphragm, I lose it. It's a big heart. It's a big heart, and I can't see the margins in the area that I lose also the diaphragm. Okay, now the lung fields, what do I think about the cranial, caudal lung fields, and whatever I see? Do they look okay, and the vessels? They look fine. Yeah, absolutely. So, let's recoup. I will go back to my writing mode. What did we find? We find liver. We cannot see it. Diaphragm. Ventrally, it's not visible. Heart, big and lost in the area the diaphragm is not visible. And is generally humongous. Look how big that is. So, combining that, is there any one condition in a cat, skeletally mature, 8 years old, potentially with no particular clinical signs, that I have a humongous heart, lose the diaphragm, and I can't see the liver and the intestines look forward. Absolutely. PPDH. So the fact that I don't see the diaphragm and I can't see the liver has to really alert me that there is a diaphragmatic hernia. But in the thorax, I only see a humongous cardiac silhouette. I can't see a liver. Most likely it's in the pericardial sac. And because it's a cat, and I know cats, they get peritoneal, pericardial diaphragmatic hernia, kind of a congenital thingy. Well done, all of you. That's the first thing I am going to actually think here. Okay. And how, next question is, J.H., you say it is a pericardial silhouette, not cardiac silhouette. I'm not sure what you mean. Would you mind explaining? I'm just reading here. Basically, it is the cardiac silhouette that looks huge, but all the stuff is in the pericardium, most likely, like the liver or whatever else is in there. So anybody can tell me what is my next step? How can I go and confirm that what I see here is actually peritoneal pericardial diaphragmatic hernia, which I'm almost certain? Absolutely, ultrasound. Putting a quick probe and basically seeing that the liver is in the pericardial sac. So something that looks kind of odd, most people may think it's heart problem, okay? Actually, it's not that complicated. What we did, I didn't wonder why it looks funky or whatever. I just went my system, you know. I check the skeletal structures, I check the shoulder, if it is there or visible, the elbow, or whatever is visible outside, the ribs, sternum, count them, and then I went to the cranial abdomen, saying, okay, where is the liver that I see there? I can't see it. Where is the stomach? Yeah, I can potentially see it. I'm not that sure, but there are a couple of areas that looks as it could be. What about the small intestines, too far cranially? And then I went into the chest. Why the trachea is dorsally displaced? Because there is a huge cardiomegaly, because of these organs in the pericardial sac. Now, before I move along, let's say raise your hand or agree, actually, from the raise your hand position to make sure everything is on the same, everybody's on the same page, before we move to the abdominal example. Excellent. Okay, if anything unclear, feel free to type a question. I'm looking at the discussion board. Now I have one more, maybe a touch cheekier, and I don't know why we try with Emmer to make it, but clearly you can see that is compressed from the side. It's not like that in the original, but actually is we tried many times to upload the lecture and somehow it always appears like that. So I do apologize about that. But again, I will go the same way. I will see the thoracic vertebrae and count whatever they are. Then the lumbar, because that's how I do it. Subcutaneous tissues. Okay. So I will check the, oops, let me get out. Okay. Now, thoracic vertebrae, lumbar, subcutaneous tissues, pelvis, femurs, stifles, tibias, wall, cardiac silhouette, whatever is visible, caudal lung, ribs, and cartilages. And then I will go into the abdomen. So, okay, liver, nice and pointy. Stomach, kind of a little bit squeezed over there. Small intestine, and you say, wait a minute, that small intestine is normal, isn't it? What about this one? And this one, they look kind of quite dilated. And why? Because they are more than the height of the body of the L5. So basically, this loop of intestine here looks kind of dilated. Why? It's more than the height of the L5. Actually, it's more than twice the height of the L5. And when it's more than twice the height of the L5, I am worried about obstruction. Actually, I have a 90%. Oh, J.H. says, I only see a VD view. That's odd. Is that anybody else has any problem? That is odd, actually, because I can see both. They are squeezed, to be honest, but I can see both. Anybody else has the same problem? Please type. JH, you're on iPad. I don't know about that because I'm on a Mac but not an iPad, so I don't know why you can't see. Anyway, if you can't see it, you have to take my word, though. You can see the dilated loop on the latter. You see the normal one and the dilated over on the VD view. But on the lateral, it's also very, very visible. So then you say, okay, where is the colon? Maybe I can see a little bit of rectum here and the colon coming, and then the urinary bladder. I can't see much of the kidneys, maybe superimposed there. They can see the right one, and I can't really see the left one. So effectively, going around the organ, then you say, okay, can I see anything else, any prostate or anything? Not for sure. So you finish up and you say, okay, I ended up with having two groups of small intestine. Okay, I have two groups of small intestine, a smaller normal one and a larger, wider one. And I will draw it also again for JH benefit on the DV. You can see the wide loop of small intestine and you can see the normal loop of small intestine. Okay, that's for JH because he can't see the lateral. For the rest of us, we concentrate, we can see on the lateral. So when I have two groups of small intestine, what is... Oh, Helen actually says she can't get any sound, so hopefully Emmer can help with that. But basically, when I have two groups of small intestine, a very dilated one and a normal one, what is the first thing I'm going to think of as a differential? Start typing now. Absolutely, Helen. Tufa, JH, fantastic. Of course, obstruction. So I will start look for any mass, any foreign body. And if it was the normal radiographs, you were in trouble because that would be my next question. Can you see it? But because they're squeezed, I feel compelled to tell you, if you look carefully on the lateral, I'm afraid it's not that visible on the VGJH, but I will put a circle around the foreign body. Can you see this gaseous appearance that we have in there? Oh, you can see that. Excellent. So, what foreign body is that, ladies and gentlemen? Let me see. Because that's the whole fun with the foreign body. Try to figure out what foreign body it is. Sometimes it's very opaque. You can see it here is more loosened, but it has this funky, characteristic gassy. Soft tissue opacity. Towel, not a bad thought, but it's kind of boxy. Actually, that's a corn cob. Here it looks a little bit squeezed because the whole radiograph looks a little bit squeezed, and I apologize again. We really tried a lot about an hour before the lecture to try to fix it, but somehow the software didn't allow it. In the cranial abdomen, plicated. I can see, actually, in the cranial abdomen, I can see the small intestine, Helen, they will call them gathered together. Usually when they are plicated, you have a gas, and if you allow my, you will see the gas bubbles, let me get the arrow out, creating kind of a pattern, something like that. And you see it in a bubbly orientation, not as continuous as we get it here. Here, if I look carefully, I can see actually the lumen and a continuous gas pattern in the cranial abdomen. So effectively, I don't think that's plicated, and it is not. If it is plicated, usually you have gas bubbles, and usually they get this kind of funky angular appearance that you see. You can see them like squeezed together. So if you can imagine a loop of intestine kind of squeeze, and you can see the gas bubbles. Sorry about my drawings, not my top. Actually, on the VDJH, you can see the loops of intestine here, but it is not plicated, as we said for Helen. You can just see continuous gas in the intestines, while when it's plicated, usually you get this plication in a gas bubble form showing. Oh, the foreign body, it's not clear at all. It's about, it's in that region, but it's not very, very clear. JH, sorry. So you can see it more on the lateral, the pattern, not on the VD. Now, if you see it, you know it's a foreign body. What will you do if you don't see it? A focal severe dilatation of the small intestine is an indication of a next lap in its own right. So effectively, even if you don't see the foreign body, still you have to find out what is causing it. Sorry, JH on the VD is not that visible. Give me now and agree if you are all on the same page, and or raise your hand and start giving a question if you are not actually clear about something so far, before I move to the musculoskeletal. You can do an ultrasound, JH. That's a choice. You can, trying to identify what's causing the obstruction. All I'm saying is you don't have to. Now, I will finish with the musculoskeletal, and that was a dog, and because we are way out of time, so I will go a little bit more quickly on that one. So in the musculoskeletal, I will do the alignment, and clearly here is a little bit interrupted in the fracture area, the bone, and when I look at the bone, I like to look at the cortex, medulla, cortex, and go from proximal to distal. Now, this case came with a sudden lameness. The dog was walking and suddenly 10 tenths lame. When you have a history like that, always worried, especially if you find a fracture like here. So I will describe the fracture, but if you look carefully, can you see the lysis in the cortex? If you look carefully, we have moth-eaten lysis in the area. So effectively, that's not just a fracture, that's a pathologic fracture. But for our description reasons, I will go from alignment, the bone, and describe the fracture and the lysis, cartilage, I will check the joints, there is no device, and then I will try and see the soft tissue, and you can see the swelling of the soft tissues around. Of course, here is not a fracture, it's a fracture with an aggressive lesion, so it's a pathologic fracture, and because of the location, I would be very worried about osteosarcoma. And whenever we are worried about a tumor, the first thing we're going to ask is a MET check of the thorax, just to make sure we don't have METs before we do anything else. Now, because we are way out of time, and I apologize, but I hope you are still enjoying it, I will just finish quickly recouping, and I will be ready for your questions. What I would recommend is actively examine the film. The only rule for you is check the whole film. What I will say is do it organ by organ. How you are going to do it, no problem. It's totally up to you, whatever suits you best. I do it from the periphery to the center, as I showed you. You can do it in whatever way you like to do it. So organ by organ. When you find a lesion that looks anything, that looks funky, unusual, you are uncertain, go through the radiographic signs. Number, size, shape, location, margination, radiopacity. When you do on radiopacity, be specific. Gas, fat, soft tissue, bone, mineral. Then, think structural change. Basically, what has changed? Why is this thing more opaque? Why is this thing more loosened? Is it more gas? Is it more fat? Is it more fluid? Is it more cells? Or a combination? And that is the type of pathology we're talking about. That will lead you to your first differential. That will be the long one. And now you have to think animal, think history, and narrow that down as much as possible to arrive at your final diagnosis, usually one lesion, usually more than one diagnosis, but sometimes, very rarely, you may end up with one. And then what you're going to do next that will give you the answer or exclude the majority of your differentials. And you will think that will take long. In the beginning, it will take you a little bit of time. With a little bit of practice, you will do it in 5 minutes, you know, very easily. So I'm ready for questioning. Thank you for your time. I don't know, my next slide doesn't appear to me. Thank you for joining me. I know we are all very, very busy, and I really appreciate having you here. I'm open to any questions you have. Please start typing. Actually, one question that I received was, let's say we have a case and it has a very obvious lesion. Do I start with that obvious lesion or I just follow my system? And that's a very, very valid question. You know. And my advice is, do however you like, but my advice is start with the obvious. Why? Because we may start from another organ normal in our system. But if it's something so obvious, I feel that half of our eye is looking at that lesion even if we try to describe something else. So my argument there is start with the obvious lesions, describe it to oblivion, finish with that, and then continue with the rest of the x-ray in the order you have decided you want to do it. Any other questions? J8 says you were using carding and pericardial card lines, maybe being picky, but should, I mean, okay, the cardiac outline, I meant not pericardial. Maybe it was a slip of the tongue, J8. It's the cardiac outline, even if it is the pericardium, still it's the cardiac outline. So usually the term I'm going to use, you're not being picky, and that is well spotted. It's a slip of the tongue. I meant the cardiac outline, and I hope that is clear to everyone. And I like to use the term cardiac instead of heart. Why? Because I want to remind myself it can be the pericardium. You know, otherwise we always think heart disease. While if I use the term cardiac, it's like a note to me, could be heart, could be pericardium. So you're right, JH, it's cardiac outline. Any other question before I let you go back to your work? If you have any questions, you know, now it's still fresh and we've been quite through a lot, feel free to email me at pmantis@rvc.ac.uk and I will be happy to answer any questions that comes to your mind. Okay, you know, if something is unclear, feel free to email me and I will be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time. Thank you for being here. And I hope you find it useful. Emer, back to you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Pete for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.